Hey everybody, welcome to this week's Q&As. As I mentioned on the podcast this week, I should be moving next month, barring anything insane happening at the last minute. And if that's the case, the last 2 weeks in August, I might have to skip the Q&As, or I might have to do something silly like prop my cell phone up on a desk and just, you know, talk to the cell phone answering it. I try not to cheese out with quality like that, but it's just a matter of will I actually have access to my equipment or will I not? So I'll figure that out as we go, but nothing else is stopping, especially none of the behind-the-scenes development work and all that stuff. That's all going full speed ahead. The only thing that might have to slow down is on-camera stuff. So I just wanted to give everybody a heads up. But anyway, let's jump in and see what we got this week. First up, Hector Santana wanted to know about a board I'd posted about a few years ago that's meant to assist people with RGB modding consumer-grade TVs. And before I begin, as always, I have to say that modding a CRT could be potentially very, very dangerous, whereas modding your Super Nintendo, as long as you remember to unplug it, is not dangerous at all. You might burn yourself, you know, maybe you're going to have a small issue, but there's no real chance, no realistic chance of death, whereas modding a CRT, there is a small chance of death. So remember that if you ever want to open one up. But to actually address the question, the board that I had talked about, I had just seen posted. I've never used it before. It was an open source design that assisted people in some of the steps that you would need in order to RGB mod these TVs. And the usual procedure is to find a TV that has an on-screen display that outputs in a way that you could tap into that signal. So there's a chip that's nicknamed the Jungle Chip that whenever you press a button on your remote, and you get nice clear text on the screen, that's actually getting generated from that chip to give you an on-screen display. So what RGB modders have done has tapped into that in a way that you could send RGB signals from a SCART connector or a VGA connector or whatever else directly to it so that it overlays right on top of the screen and bypasses all of the other processing. So some of the RGB modded TVs I've seen looked better than component, but I don't think it has anything to do with the signals at all. I think it's just that we're bypassing all of the cheap electronics that were on the board or aging electronics or something else. So there's a bunch of reasons that people might want to do it that way. This board is just to simplify that. Some of the circuits that you might have to install by hand, this one would take the place of it. It's got jumper pins in order to help simplify the process. But overall, it's not anything that you couldn't do by yourself. And I mean that respectfully. I'm not talking down to the people or person who made this board. I'm just saying it's just something to assist the process. So you asked the question, does it work on TVs without jungle chips? Does anyone sell it pre-assembled? Are there similar products available? No, it doesn't work on TVs without jungle chips because it's just a way to simplify that process. I don't know if anybody sells it pre-assembled, and I do know a bunch of people have made their own similar things for specific TVs. I believe somebody made one for one model TV that everybody seems to be modding lately, and I think a few years ago somebody made it for another one that was popular then. But they're all just ways to simplify what you could already do. So one day I'll go back and, you know, especially if I end up with a place where I have enough space to do this, I would actually love to go back and do a step-by-step how to RGB mod a TV. I have that video I did with Jose a while back, which is it's the first video we did together. It's it's way before I got better practice, so it's not even close to my best video, but it gives you the process kind of as an overview, but it doesn't really walk you through it because respectfully, I don't want beginners to do this. I don't want a beginner to pop the back off a CRT and go, oh yeah, Bob showed me how to discharge it and just grab the anode cup and get electrocuted, you know, because that's really dangerous. If you have a heart problem, even if you have a heart problem you're not aware of, that could kill you. So it's a very distinct balance. You have channels like RetroTech USA, Steve, that the entire channel is dedicated to stuff like this. So it's my opinion, and I could be wrong, but if you walk into, it's like walking into an auto shop where you have cars up on a lift. You immediately know that there's cars up on lifts and there could potentially be danger, right? You go to Steve's channel and you immediately know what you're looking at. You know, this person mods TVs, refurbishes them. This is about CRTs. Whereas you go to Retro RGB and you get everything from a game review to an insane technical analysis on an HDMI switch. Like, anybody could be coming, and I don't want a beginner to walk into this and say, oh, okay, I got this. This looks easy, and just half listen and half pay attention and get in trouble. So That's kind of the main reason why I haven't gone back, that in space, but why I haven't gone back and done another video on that is just because, respectfully, I don't want beginners to start doing this. I want to do it in a way where you feel like you have to be at least intermediate to expert, but at that point, then you should be able to get it done. And for the record, experts should be able to watch the video with Jose and I and just go, oh, it makes total sense. I'll figure it out myself from here on. So it's kind of going to take the other side of that. I think the video I do, I'd rather concentrate more on things like, you know, showing light guns still working. That's a question I get all the time. Yes, they do. Showing the quality difference with a good camera and a good CRT shot and demonstrating how that could be, you know, processing versus signal quality versus calibration. I think stuff like that is probably what I'd like to concentrate on. But any suggestions, I'm all ears. So I think that was a way too long answer for your question, but hey, at least I got you all the info I had on it. Marcello Medini wanted to know if I had tested the Otaku switch that does the RGB to component video conversion right on the switch itself. This is the $100 switch that looks very similar to the one that I always recommend as a great beginner switch. And no, I haven't tested it myself. Marcello's concern was main concern would be if it's outputting safe voltages. So my guess would be that it would be safe. Now, I have not tested it, so please keep that in mind. But my speculation would be that a product like this would most likely be safe to use, but may not be the best video quality. And I mean zero disrespect to Otaku Games when I say that. And I've spoken to Maurice before. I'm a fan of their products. I just mean, generally speaking, doing this kind of video conversion is not easy, and it gets even harder in the context of video games. Because when you do these conversions with TV signals that have strict video standards that they adhered to, it's, you know, you're really only concentrating on one thing, or maybe two things. But when you're talking about video game consoles that each potentially output their own different signal, you have to be a lot more stringent. And that's why products like the HD Retrovision cables and the RGB to comp from Mike Chi, RetroTink, that's why those are such a big deal, because they're designed by retro gamers for retro gamers to try to cover all of that ground. And, you know, Otaku Games are retro gamers and they do make great products, but without testing it, it's really hard to be able to say. And I've even tested a community-made converter that was pretty bad. And, you know, at first glance, it seemed fine. But then you started to really dig into the signal, and you could see a lot of colors getting ruined. You could see the signal getting hurt. Still not unsafe from a voltage point of view, but it's not great to look at. So my guess, and once again, guess, would be that if you wanted to try this out just to have everything easily built into one thing, I think it would be safe to try, but have realistic expectations. You know, Otaku Games, they've been great to work with, but, you know, I don't know how good they are at making converters, right? It's just, it is what it is. It's not an insult. It's not a compliment. It's just basic facts. So if you want to go with known tested products, I would get the Otaku regular 6-port switch and then get the RGB to comp from Mike Chi. But I don't know. I would feel comfortable giving this a try and just knowing that you might end up with something that doesn't perform as well as the other options. But all speculation, 100%. And one of these days, I'd love to talk to Maurice, maybe even do an interview and really get the story behind Otaku Games and all of that stuff. And maybe if, you know, once life opens up a little bit more, they have an expo over there I'd love to be part of as well. So we'll see. But my basic advice for this is it should be fine. I wouldn't expect any voltage issues, but I can never give a recommendation without personally testing it because it's my weird OCD. It is. That's all it is. Ray Cerrone said, they apologize if they misinterpreted my words, but they have to ask for clarity. Last week, I said that I wouldn't use the outputs on a PVM or BVM unless it was going to another RGB monitor. They know I said that's a discussion for another time, but they're curious. Could you please elaborate on why? Sure. The reason I worded it that way is because I didn't want to confuse the answer of the question that I was answering. Because this little caveat that I'm going to explain in most cases has nothing to do with just linking two monitors together. So when you go from one PVM to another PVM, you should always check the spec sheets to make sure there's no voltage limitations, to make sure there's nothing weird. But generally speaking, if you go from a 20M2U to a BVM D20 and you link them together with a BNC in and out ports, you're totally fine. You don't have anything to worry about. Any video signals should be fine on that. And if they're not compatible, you know, just turn the monitor off right away. But when you're going from BNC outputs to something like a SCART input, you need to make sure that the voltages adhere to SCART standards. The RGB lines are most likely fine, but you will very commonly run into a scenario where you're outputting a TTL level higher voltage sync on the sync line, and you know, most monitors would be able to handle that without any problems at all. Some require you to flip a switch in the back, you know, some just accept them all, a few don't, so please, like I said, always look up the spec sheets. But generally speaking, linking two PVMs together should be fine, but linking two PVMs and then an open source scan converter at the end, you're going to want to make sure you know the voltages. And generally speaking, if you do something like you take a BNC to SCART adapter and you put a 470 ohm resistor on the sync line, the worst thing that could possibly happen in most cases is nothing. You dropped the sync voltage too low, the OSSC or RetroTINK doesn't sync on it, and it's fine, you figure it out from there. So, you know, if you want to test this stuff, I would say you might be okay doing that. But if you were to just do a basic BNC to SCART pass-through adapter and you're sending TTL level voltages, by the time it gets to the OSSC, you're still sending too much voltage. So that's the only scenario in which I would say be careful, or pretty much whenever you're going from monitor to monitor to not a monitor, make sure that the voltages line up. So, I mean, I guess I could just always go back and say, always check your voltages, but I wanted to clarify specifically what I was talking about to answer your question and to clarify about last week. To continue with your post, you're just concerned you might be doing something harmful with your streaming setup. Right now, you use whichever console to a Retro Access SCART cable, to a WookieWin SCART to BNC cable, to your 14M2U, to another BNC to SCART output cable, to the SCART RetroTINK 2X SCART, to HDMI to one of the cant links. So honestly, that sounds perfect. The Retro Access cables, unless you specifically bought like a BNC cable that you needed higher voltage on, should all output the proper SCART voltage. So that is the scenario in which you shouldn't ever have to worry about anything at all, because all the voltages that you start with are the correct voltage for your SCART equipment that you end with. So that's actually an excellent setup, by the way. Like that is a cost-efficient, really great way to do this stuff, because you leave your BNC cable just kind of dangling. You don't worry about SCART switches until you save up to get a G-SCART or something. But then that way you plug whatever your console you want into it, and it automatically just goes right out your streaming setup. And you know, those cant links, I've tested a couple. One barely worked at all, and the other one was fine. So, you know, and not only that, but when you output 480p to OBS, you could just double that to 960p using point scaling and OBS, essentially having yourself an almost 1080p stream. So I think that's an excellent setup that's really cost efficient. The only thing you said is you do notice the picture dims slightly once you connect the RetroTINK. That is normal, but and that's kind of the scenario that goes a little deeper that I don't want to get into at this point, but that basically goes into a technical explanation of why going through these monitors that you could link the ins and outs is different than using a Y cable. To be honest, if I did that explanation, I would want Stee or Voltar or somebody with me to make sure I got it exactly right. But yeah, so I would just say that you're most likely 99.9% should be safe in this exact setup. Whereas if you just used like a Y cable on each of the RGBS lines and split it to both, you probably wouldn't. So that's a great setup. I stream that way as well. And hopefully I clarified everything that you were curious about. Red-Crested Regal said they have a combo Blu-ray VHS player hooked up to their NEC XP29 Plus monitor via component video through a couple of different converters and switches. And they're having some kind of issues with movie playback. The picture's all weird is the description. So there's a few things that I'd want to suggest. First and foremost, whenever you're troubleshooting anything, try skipping as much of the stuff as you can. None of the things that you mentioned, the GCOM switch, the G-SCART switch, any of that stuff, seem like it could cause a problem, but it's always best to just go directly to the target device and then step it back from there just in case. So I would go directly into the converter that you mentioned, the Xtron CVC300, and then into the XP29 and see if it still looks that way. If it does, the next step would be to really go through the manual of the CVC300 and make sure there's no settings that need to be tweaked, there's nothing that needs to be configured. Really just go through and make sure there's no issues with that converter. And then you kind of have to make a choice at that point. So you mentioned that you're not having any of these issues through composite video, but you are through component. And you mentioned that it could be potentially because of MacroVision protection. So if that's the case, you could try a different converter. Try picking up the RGB or the comp to RGB from RetroTINK. Or you could try a few other things. And I would make your next step, I would determine your next step based on any equipment you already own or the cheapest option. Because, you know, fellow nerds have a lot of extra weird equipment laying around. So there's a chance that you might have something like an HDMI to component video converter. And on top of that, there's also a chance that you might have one of those HDMI splitters that allows you to capture PS3 so you don't have to worry about this stuff. So if you have both of those, I would try the HDMI output, of course, set to 480p, in through the splitter into the HDMI to component converter and try that. If that solves it, then, you know, some kind of MacroVision was the issue, or could have been. Or if you have to just start from scratch, I would probably pick up the RetroTINK device just because the Xtrons are amazing, great company, great products, but they're all getting much older now. So unless you happen to buy that new and, you know that the electronics are in good condition, I have seen capacitors go bad in like the 203 RXIs and stuff like that. So, you know, it's absolutely no slander to Xtron, but all capacitors are going to die at some point. And if you're using stuff that's 20, 30 years old, who knows? So those are the two suggestions. Either try the HDMI output and go from there, or try a different converter. But I'm really interested to hear how you end up solving this, because while MacroVision is a thing, I would assume that you would have also seen it through composite video. Maybe not, because you're going to, if you would go directly into the monitor, you probably wouldn't see it. But if you went through some converter, you might. So that, you know what, now that I say that out loud, yeah, it could be some kind of MacroVision protection, but all the time I end up using my PS3 and other devices with component video, and I never run into any of this stuff, and specifically for movie watching. Worst case too, you could always try to get any kind of video-based converter, because remember, this is for movies and TV, not for video games. So if you end up with a laggy converter, doesn't matter at all, because you're not playing games through it. So there's different ways that we could solve it, but I would start with what I suggested and go from there. And please keep me updated, because I'm kind of interested in this. Next, a question from Timotishi. Is that a play on Timothy, or am I just absolutely killing the pronunciation of your name? I'm so sorry. No disrespect. If you've been following the channel, you know I'm just terrible at that, but I do try real hard. And I'm also sorry that apparently you posted this question last week and it seems to have disappeared on Patreon. Patreon is still doing that. They have not fixed that. I do not delete comments at all from the Q&As. I don't think I've ever done that. So I'm really sorry. There's just nothing I could do about it. It's a Patreon thing. But anyway, a few weeks ago, I talked about modding tools and specifically talked about magnification options. A lot of people don't like that dentist style over the head magnification visor. So they figured out different products that they might want to pick up, and they found one on Amazon that's only about $60 that they liked very much. So this device seems to have an LCD screen attached to it, and it's an overhead microphone, and there is a small plate, but it also looks like it's mounted in a way where you could unbolt it from the plate and bolt it to a desk, or you might even be able to slide this off and put it on a mechanical arm of yourself, same way I would do like a mic stand. And it also has USB output, so you're looking at the LCD screen, but you could also output to record what you're doing. And for $60, that looks pretty cool. You know, it's obviously not going to be the same as a $500 really expensive fancy one where you look in the visors and you're focusing on the eye lens and on the magnification lens, but $60 is a pretty good price for something like that. And to be honest, once I move and I'm settled, I might pick up one of those just to try. Even if I do end up getting an expensive one eventually, I think that's a perfect starter one as long as it performs pretty well. But you said you like it, so I will leave a link in the description to this. Just respectfully, please know that, you know, this is something that so far one person has vouched for. No disrespect to you at all. I'm just saying, you know, products like this usually should have a few eyes on them. So if you want to be a beta tester for your mods and you want a I don't want to say cheap, but a much more inexpensive magnifying solution, I'll post the link for this one. Thank you very much for sharing it. But overall, based on your description, it looks totally fine. You said that you've used it to install and inspect DC Digital and PS1 Digital, and it was great for aligning the flexes, checking for bridges not visible to the naked eye, and making sure IC pins and surface mount caps were properly wetted. The firmware has at least a few bugs that they found when attempting to save photos and videos, but nothing they couldn't work around, and only if you care about the live shots not taking photos and video, then it works fine. Or, and if you only care about looking through the lens, it works fine. It's only a recording issue. So yeah, awesome. I'm always really happy to get recommendations like this, so I will definitely post it in the link. Post the link in the description, and I will also check it out myself once I have a spot to install it. So thanks very much for sharing. Ishan wanted to know what's the easiest way to split up component video so they could play on a consumer CRT set without a pass-through and capture and stream at the same time. They'd like to avoid getting G-Comp or ShinyBow-like switches since they're expensive and they're not interested in the switch functionality. Would it be possible to simply use Y-splitter cables for all three signals? If so, would there be image degradation? They're looking to do this on a budget. So definitely do not use Y-splitter cables for video signals ever. Yes, there is image degradation, but there's also a serious chance that you could blow out the chip on your console. I've done this before with a Super Nintendo, and I essentially Y-cabled an RGB solution for a testbed thing I was doing, and it died fairly quickly. It was a matter of hours, not days or weeks or months. So never ever use Y-splitter cables. I would look for cheap video distribution amps. So this equipment back in the early 2000s, when component video was really starting to become more mainstream, was expensive, and it was used for things like you walk into a Circuit City or a Best Buy and all of the TVs have the same thing on it and stuff like that. So they're usually really, you know, if you buy a good brand, they're good quality, but because they're not used anymore, you could get them dirt cheap. Focus chimed in and reminded me that a while back I recommended the Audio Authority 985U. Focus used that, and it seems it's totally fine. You could also look into Xtron equipment, but basically any kind of component video distribution amp is probably the best way to do this. You know, I'm sure there's stuff that you could find that will also allow for two outputs. There are certain things that we used, like the comp cleaner. Voltar has his version that has two outputs that you could buy a bunch of converters to make. But to be perfectly honest, in your situation, I think looking around, you know, find any powered distribution amp or powered component switch that has two outputs on eBay and give it a try. Go for the cheapest. If you could, if there's Audio Authority available, give that a try. If there's Xtron available, give that a try. But yeah, I think I would just look for a powered box that specifically specs two simultaneous outputs at the same time, and you should be pretty good. Red-crested Regal wants to know, would there be any difference, quality or otherwise, between sending their scaler an RGB signal directly from their G-SCART switch versus having the signal go from their G-SCART into their PVM-14M4U and then into the scaler from the outputs? This would allow them to have a free output on the G-SCART switch, but they definitely don't want to sacrifice signal quality. Anytime you add something to the chain of an analog video signal, you will lose quality. Now, whether that's visible to the naked eye is up to you. I've seen some monitors where I do that and it looks identical. I've seen some where it's a little dimmer, and I've seen some where red constantly drops out. I had a monitor where if you wiggled the output of the BNC output on the red line, red would just drop off from all signals. So obviously that's age. That's not a problem with the model monitor I was using. So I would say if it all looks fine to you, leave it, you know, leave well enough alone. You could, of course, always check by just doing still captures for both and seeing if you could notice a difference. But overall, I think you should probably, unless you're already noticing a problem, you should be fine. And another question, does the PVM need to be turned on for its BNC outputs to be passing the signal through? Nope, you could leave that powered off if you'd like. Focus wants to know if I know of any stores that are selling the CPS I/O boards or a short kick harness. And I don't know of any stores selling them, but I'm sure they're probably out there. You probably just have to do some searches or maybe ask on an arcade forum. But two things to keep in mind. If you make one of these yourself, it's pretty easy. You know, the JAMA connector is always going to be a pain in the ass, but you know, generally speaking, it's a fairly easy thing to build. But of course, you know, if you order the PCBs that are going to come in threes, if you order the parts from all of these different places, you're going to spend more in shipping than in the parts. So it's probably better to just make all three and then sell the other two. So that's something to keep in mind. The other thing that you might want to keep in mind is a project that should be out this year. So I'll take a step back for a moment. The CPS I/O boards are designed to be super guns without audio and video output for the specific purpose of taking a Capcom Play System 1, 2, or 3 that has the HDMI kit installed in it that is going to be for somebody that only uses HDMI out. So this board would only be for controls and power, essentially, and if you need to, you know, extra service and test buttons or something like that. So overall, it's fairly easy and cheap, but there is a project that should have been out already that looks kind of like the CPS I/O, but it also includes audio and video and has voltage protection built into the audio side, and you should almost definitely get perfect voltage on the video side as well. And if you're buying one pre-made, it might be about the same price. So it sounds like you're ready to do this now and you're willing to make your own. So, you know, making three and selling two, you should be able to break even, you know, or close to it. So I guess if you're on a budget, that's probably the better way to go. But if you're not in a rush to do this and you're not on a specific budget, you might want to just think about that, because even if most of your setup is always going to be HDMI, if there's a chance that you need analog as well, that's something that you might want to add to it. But I just wanted to throw that out there. The direct answer to your question, I don't know of any stores, but somebody should be doing it. And if you got to make your own, that's a fairly easy project compared to a lot of the other stuff we talk about. Retro Music Dan said, I've mentioned Y cables are dangerous and could hurt your equipment. Pardon my ignorance, but what's a Y cable, and could I clarify how or why it's a danger? So this is a Y cable. Anybody watching on video, it should be pretty obvious why they call it a Y cable, because when you hold it up like this, it kind of looks like the letter Y. But it's essentially combining or splitting just by wiring it into a cable. And in the context of video, you should never use it. In the context of audio, it's pretty much always fine. Some background on this. Now, as I proved in that video with Steve from HD Retrovision, or as Steve proved and I showed in the video, it's electrically safe to combine or split audio signals. You might get quieter audio if you split it. You might get some kind of noise or some kind of signal degradation if you combine, but it's not going to hurt your equipment. And that's something I get in an argument with somebody every time I talk about this. There's always some know-it-all that thinks they're a genius because they quoted some scientific paper. And if you're that person, you need to take a deep breath and think about what it is that you're doing. Context, people. In the context of stuff like combining left and right audio to go into a PVM so you could use its mono speaker, yeah, you probably are going to get some signal degradation doing that, but you're also using a speaker built into a PVM, so you're clearly not chasing quality here. I use mine all the time for testing, for live streams, so I could hear the audio before I put my headphones on. So there's a million reasons why you might want to use that. That's not even your main source of audio. It's just something that you want it there. And in the context of audio, you're always fine. Check out the video with Ste. I don't want to oversimplify it, but it's a great explanation, and it proves with visuals on an oscilloscope why voltage is never... I hate to say never, but in the context of what we do in retro gaming, it should never be an issue using Y cables with audio. Now, video, on the other hand, is a completely different story because you're putting a load on the chip that drives the video signal. So putting a Y cable on it, most people say, oh, I've done that, and it just makes it a little bit darker. Well, the reason it makes it a little bit darker is because you're drawing twice the load and the chips cannot keep up with that. Now, there are some exceptions. Some chips are designed to handle two outputs. Some chips are probably robust enough that it would last a while doing it that way, but they're not really... In the average scenario, the opposite of audio, in the average retro gaming scenario, it's not good, and you could potentially kill the equipment because you're drawing twice as much. So, I mean, it's kind of like anything else, right? It's like, you know, your car is rated at 8,000 RPMs, but you run it at 16,000 RPMs. You know, it might last a little bit if you do it that way, but eventually you're going to blow it out way faster. So that's kind of the oversimplified solution. But generally speaking, when you're talking about these things, RCA cables that split or combine, when you're using them in retro gaming with audio, you're pretty much fine. And when don't ever, ever use them with video in any video signal, composite, S-video, RGB, unless you very specifically know that the setup that you've built is verified and able to do this. But most aren't, so I just would never count on it. Question from Louis Cesaron, the person known for abandoning a perfectly good CRT at a flea market just because it wouldn't fit on the plane with him. Just kidding. Check out his video if you want to see what I'm talking about. But Louis has a couple of Wii questions. First, which Wii to HDMI solutions do I know off the top of my head? They're looking to lag test these devices, and pretty much every device on AliExpress or Amazon is the same shaped dongle with different text. So there's a couple of huge problems with this. You could buy one of each, or you could buy 10 of the exact same one, and they could all potentially be different. And that's why I almost never recommend them, because I could set up an Amazon link, and I could buy 5, and all could be perfect, and you could buy one, and it could be garbage. And that's true for a lot of the stuff I link on Amazon. A lot of the cheap HDMI equipment would fall into the same category, but the reason I'm confident listing those is because the best alternatives, you could pretty much add a zero to the end of that price. Whereas when you're talking about a Wii, if you get HD Retrovision cables and a known good component to HDMI converter, you're pretty much going to have an excellent solution. It's just obviously more expensive, but not ridiculously more expensive. You know, just like, okay, you know, I know you got to pay for quality type of thing. But to explain why, so there's a few factors. First, the chips, and second, the board layout. Board layout's been less of an issue, but if a board is laid out badly, even with the best chips, it's going to be like using unshielded cables. That's pretty much like the Hyperkin Xbox solutions. Zero lag, but total garbage because you have all of the interference on screen. And they're totally fine if you're just saving up for like an Xbox HDMI solution, but not good if you're as like a main thing to go to. And it's the same potentially with the Wii ones. The other side of that is the chips themselves. Some pass all of the signals absolutely perfect, and essentially for a $20 device, you're getting exactly the same as HD Retrovision cables and a good analog to digital converter. But trying to hunt those exact ones down are hard and getting harder. Most of them either crush the black levels or don't support 240p at all or have some kind of weird issue. Now, the very good news is none of those that I've tested, at least, have ever added lag. I believe there are some that say, like, scale to 1080p. I would assume that those do add a bunch of lag, but just the basic analog to digital converters should add zero. So that is the one bonus of using those, but you do have those other things to worry about. So as a short-term solution, maybe you buy it as a short-term solution and it works with all the resolutions and the black levels work fine and you don't get any interference, beautiful, then just keep it permanently. So I would suggest it from that perspective, but anybody that buys those, I would make sure that you go into that thinking, I might have to upgrade at some point to something else. But for the price, it's certainly worth trying, at least, if you know that's going to be your main use case. Another, you know, the other side of that is if you're going to be using your Wii on a CRT and a flat panel, just get the HD Retrovision cables and a converter. Other question, do I know of any place to find the AV port from a Wii without just taking one for parts? So I don't, but I think people have done that. I know for a fact there's a bunch of designs for the Super Nintendo multi-out, but I'm pretty sure people have done that for the Wii as well. So I would check Thingiverse, I would check OSH Park and see exactly what's out there. You might even want to contact the maker of the Xbox to Wii project to see if they had ever modified their 3D printed design in order to work for an original Wii. But if you're talking about the case of like somebody broke off the multi-out port, I would kind of look into any of those. You could probably direct wire as well, but that's a giant pain. So I don't know of any. I hope people have already done that, and I would kind of search through those places to see. And if anybody knows, of course, please post in the comments of these videos. Couple of questions from Jason Guffey. First, they were trying to repurpose an old laptop, and by mistake, they made a scratch on the board near a ground point via. And they're not sure if they caused a bigger short. They tried disconnecting the grounds around it. They tried checking for continuity, but they still get a little bit of tone in the multimeter when checking between power and ground. I am definitely not the person to give any advice on this, because what you did and where you did it and what type of board you did it on will make a huge factor in this. So just for an example, right? If you're working on a very, very basic circuit board, a two-layer or even a one-layer board, and you did that, you could very easily isolate, add new traces. I don't want to say easily, but it wouldn't be hard to repair something like that. But what if you got a much more complicated board, and you specifically said an old laptop? So that's not just a four-layer board. That could also be a six-layer or an eight-layer board. So if you were using a razor blade and you cut through multiple layers, that could be completely destroyed forever. So I'm not trying to shame you. I mean, you know, we all got to make mistakes, obviously. But I'm just saying I wouldn't even know where to begin on something like that complicated. And even if I did understand, I don't know if I'm the best person to give advice on how to repair it or if it could be repaired. So I would probably go to an expert channel and ask the question there. And, you know, this is just practice, right? If you ended up accidentally ruining an old laptop, it stinks, but hey, way better than a brand new laptop, right? Always look at the bright side of stuff like that. So hopefully you could repair it, but I don't know. I'd be very cautious with something like that. Next, looks like Jason enjoyed the stream with Voltar, even though they don't see themselves being an AV professional anytime soon. Yeah, that device was definitely, without a shadow of a doubt, for pros only. I've been doing follow-ups to that and finding much cheaper devices that do all the very basics of things that we would need. I do still think those HD Fury devices have a purpose. I just don't think it's at all really for retro gaming. I think it's pro streamers and pro AV equipment. But when I say pro AV, I mean in a professional environment, not just people that like a pro setup at their house. I mean, technically, I'm one of those people, but I think that's really something that that's not many people would use. Great devices, by the way. Excellent. Just for the money, I would try to find cheaper solutions. And one of the things is compatibility with like PlayStation 3 to a capture card. That's the example I used, but the bigger issue, and an issue I've been dealing with since I owned a Luva Articos, no, I think I had the Aconda first back in the early 2000s, was that HDMI devices were coming out that did not have component video, that were not compatible. You couldn't do any kind of conversion. And that's insane to me because, I luckily got all of those TVs for an insane deal, but if I had paid full price, that might have been like $5,000 for a TV that couldn't play a new DVD player at the time. So devices that get around that are incredibly helpful. And in fact, 99% of the time that I've used devices like that were for legitimate reasons. So you could find splitters and audio extractors that allow you to do that. Splitters are way easier to find. The ones in my Amazon store all seem to work. I mean, that's actually, I shouldn't say all seem to work. That goes back to what I was talking about with Lewis a few questions ago about you could buy 10 of something and each one might be slightly different. It's the same thing with these HDMI devices. You know, you could buy 10 and 9 might work with your PS3, but one won't. The reason I'm comfortable recommending those as opposed to those cheap Wii analog to digital converters is the price difference. So, you know, you could buy one of these $20 or $30 HDMI splitters that allows you to use your PS3 on an old TV or something like that. Or you could spend $400 or $200 in the HD Fury stuff. I think it's worth taking the chance to save so much money. Whereas with the Wii, I would just say, you know, I would either say try whatever you want at your own risk, or here's the correct solution to buy. So yeah, I'll leave a link to the splitters I use. Start with a splitter. I'm still trying to determine an audio extractor. That's the one that I linked to has been out of stock forever, but it's HDMI in, it's optical Toslink out, RCA optical out, and a 3.5 millimeter jack for just stereo. So it's HDMI in and you get all of the audio choices for output plus HDMI out. I use that on my data path right now and I love it. It does not take care of things like PS3, but it does the perfect type of audio conversion, doesn't crush colors, etc. But it's out of stock, so I'm looking at a new one. I'm looking to find a replacement for it. There's a brand, EasyCo. I actually have it sitting right in front of me because I was just testing it. They have some good stuff, but the one that I was specifically wanting that I just described with all the audio options, they're out of stock too. So I guess for your scenario, I would try one of the splitters that I have listed. One of them does have audio out, but not all of the options that I just mentioned. And of course, as soon as the other one comes out, I'll certainly update it. But yeah, going into an older HD CRT with a DVI or component video input, going into older projectors, going into older CRTs, there are so many very, very legitimate reasons of why people would want to take an HDMI device and watch their content on it that these converters would allow you to do. Lastly, they wanted to follow up about losing video on their GameCube Mark II. Turns out it's a common issue with a device with loose connectors. Yeah, that's what I was trying to allude to without being too rude last time. But they were kind of known, all of the Eons were kind of known to have their connectors not be the most secure on the inside. I think their original one, I think some of them were fine, and I think it was the Super 64 one, the clone device, that was really bad, but I don't know. I think I kind of lost my faith in Eon. So I would just, if you could repair it, cool. It looks like you did. But in the future, I would just stick with any of the other suggested solutions. Rick Lewis said, I started the weekly roundup saying I'll be moving. Am I finally leaving the city? Will I finally have room to do stuff without swapping things in and out constantly? Good luck with the move. Well, first, thank you very much. But yeah, I'm finally leaving the city and going back to the burbs, which would allow me to have a much bigger space to work out of. I do absolutely love New York City. I always have. I grew up coming here for concerts and stuff. I knew I would like living here, but I didn't know I would love living here as much as I do. But it just, it really just comes down to money. I don't want to sound shallow or anything, but you know, living in a tiny, tiny little place, trying to make it work versus spending a lot less money a month on a very large place comparatively. I'm not moving to a mansion or anything, but compared to where I'm working now, yeah, it's going to be much bigger. It was the right move. So unfortunately, I am going to miss the city a lot, but it's going to be very nice to do a live stream and not stop in the middle of the live stream to go, all right, well, give me a minute to box all this stuff back up because I have no room to pull out the thing that I need to test next. Like, it'll be nice just to have a normal size folding table so I could just slide stuff over and continue on. And yeah, even things like setting up shots. I mean, unless anybody's tried to do this consistently for a living, you don't really realize how much time is wasted. You know, if you're, and I don't mean any disrespect. I hope this isn't coming across condescending or anything, but if you make videos for fun, a couple times a month, a couple times a year, you know, it might be annoying to set up and tear down, but imagine that 3 or 4 times a week. So set up, you know, to grab the white box was the biggest time saver I bought in years, because I used to have to set up both of my, unpack and set up both lights, then set up my normal little white box, then set up my camera equipment. I mean, it was legit 40 minutes of tear down and set up every time. Whereas the all-in-one white box that I use, you just pop it open. It's 3 minutes of setup and 3 minutes of tear down. So stuff like that is a huge deal, and it's going to allow, I put a lot of hours into this, and it's going to cut a lot out just because of stuff like that. So I'm going to miss the city. I'm still going to see all my friends here, but I'm going to miss the ability to walk out my apartment door, walk 15 minutes, and, you know, either be at a subway where I could go visit awesome people, or be right at awesome people's houses and that's apartments. So yeah, I'm definitely going to miss all of that stuff, but I think allowing me to have a space that I could actually work out of would be cool. And I'm wondering about the audio difference, because right now there has not been a video since I moved to New York that I've been able to complete without at least once a horn or a truck or a siren or a wizard coming by and causing some noise and having me to stop my recording. I'm wondering if it's what it's going to be like in the burbs, because while it's quieter, the overall ambient noise is a lot lower. So is just a car driving by without making any real noise going to interfere? Is there going to be, you know, am I going to run into lawnmowers going off while I'm trying to record? So I'm interested to see what overall is actually going to be worse, but I'll stop rambling about this shit. I just wanted to answer your question, and it's obviously on the forefront of my mind, so I just figured I'd talk about it, but thanks for the question. The Retro Channel said they already tried to post this question, but it disappeared after they tried to edit it. Maybe they tripped Patreon spam filter. I'm so sorry. That's the second time this week. It's so insulting that the only feature that Patreon offers is comments. The only one. We link to all other services. The only thing that they directly offer is comments, and they're broken, and they've been broken. So I'm really sorry. I've complained. They completely blew off the complaint. I think people who have subscribed have complained. I don't think they've gotten an answer either. So all I could say is I'm really sorry. And I think it's insulting to both of us. But your actual question, do I have any suggestions for a USB capture device that correctly processes 240p by composite and S-video? Component in RGB would also be nice, but not strictly necessary. They're looking for something to test video mods on various systems, and it seems the best way to do this is to run the output from the system being modded into a capture device and compare screenshots before and after making any changes to the system being worked on. They're currently using a cheap, easy cap device, but it processes everything as 480p, which could lead to false artifacts. And while their scope is handy to see that they're getting correct voltages, the capture device makes it a lot easier to see the effect modifications have on the image being output. Lag time doesn't matter, and the less filtering, the better. They're thinking maybe the Elgato HD or perhaps a RetroTINK 2X into an HDMI to USB capture device, but keen to hear any other solutions. So, honestly, I've been where you are before. I've had the exact same question. And every single time I tried a different solution, the real answer was, first and foremost, if you have any way of integrating a desktop PC into this, grab one and grab a DataPath Vision capture card. I actually have a bunch of PCs laying around that I got to sell off. So if you're in the New York area, DM me, because I already have some of this stuff built in. But the reason, and it's the same reason that I talked about in the review I just posted this morning about the AverMedia Live Gamer 4K, is that the DataPath doesn't change the signal at all. Whatever it accepts is what you see. So now for direct analog, yeah, you could mess with it, but for HDMI captures, they really are the best I've tested, because they were well over $1,000 when they were new, like $100 used now, give or take, depending on the popularity that week. So I wouldn't mess with any other capture card if you have the ability to have a desktop. Now, if you're on a laptop, you could try to get something like the Magewell captures, which are, you know, are pretty good. You could try to get, you could try one of the Cant links and just run it in 480p 60, but know that you could get frame drops with that. Or you could try to find anything in the middle. But I really think that using a RetroTINK into that is going to be a better way to do exactly what it is you're trying to do. And at the end of the day, you're going to have to spend a little bit more money up front, but the time that you're going to save in figuring out what's a capture issue? What are you seeing because of the capture device versus the actual mod? That's another thing. So, you know, if you're stuck using USB like I was for a couple of years, you could definitely pick up some devices that'll work. The Epiphan DVI to USB 3.0, they have other ones that kind of look like that, but get that exact one used on eBay. The new Magewell USB one, I think, is good, but get ones that don't really mess with the image. And for composite and S-video, the RetroTINK 2X is more than enough. For RGB and component, if you're using a data path, you could go direct or you could go through any of the other devices. But that's honestly my suggestion. You could even, if you switch to a desktop, you could even get some Hodgepodge solutions for composite and S-video direct, so you don't need a scaler at all. You do need to make sure that you change the settings to compensate for the fact that it is 240p, but that's totally doable and a great solution. So I guess that's kind of the three things that you would need to determine. Desktop versus laptop. Can you not have a desktop at all? And if that's the case, check out some good USB solutions. If you can have a desktop, you might be able to go direct without any scaler whatsoever using like a Hodgepodge card and the data path. Or you could just get a data path and a RetroTINK or whatever else you want to do. But that's definitely what I would suggest, especially if you're doing mods and you really want to dig deep into the differences between stuff. So if you want me to elaborate any more, let me know. But I guess I figured I'd start with the overview and go from there. Well, that's it for this week. If you're new to these Q&As, ask any question you have, just please ask it in the latest Q&A post, wherever it is that you support. The way these services work, I can't really figure out what's a new question on an old post, and I do really like just scrolling through in real time and answering them live style, even though this isn't live. I just think it's kind of fun to do it that way. So any question you got, fire away in the latest Q&A post. If I have to miss a week because of the move, I'll make sure to let everybody know the details about that, but even on the weeks I have had to skip, I've never skipped questions. I've always gone back and caught up, so that shouldn't be a problem. And as always, thank you all so much for your support, because it is your support that's keeping all of this stuff going. So thank you all very much, and I'll see you next week.